From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A recent poll suggests that more than 20% of the American people think it's possible the Holocaust never happened. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Deborah Lipstadt about the movement that is trying to rewrite history and deny the Holocaust happened. She says this movement shows the fragility of reason and society's susceptibility to far-fetched ideas. Also today, redesigning the suburbs, we talk with architect and planner Peter Calthorpe. He says cities shouldn't be the only place where people can walk to the store, the school, and the movies. And writer Anne Lamott continues her chronicle of life with her young son, Sam. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations announced today that the commander of the Italian forces in Somalia will be sent back to Rome, and the Italian force of more than 2,000 men in Mogadishu will be redeployed elsewhere in Somalia. The moves come after the Italian commander, Bruno Loi, criticized the operation. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
UN officials say the Italian contingent under General Loi had become increasingly difficult to work with. Not only were the Italians engaging in operations without keeping the UN command informed, they had opened private peace negotiations with the local warlord, General Mohamed Farah Aidid. For its part, the Italians were openly critical of the UN operation, arguing that it was losing sight of its humanitarian goals. As a result, the Italians were told to withdraw General Loi and offered the opportunity to redeploy outside of Mogadishu. The incident is clearly a major embarrassment for Italy. But the Italians are not alone in not following orders. At least three other countries, at one time or another, have refused to immediately obey commands. But UN officials say because Italy was the worst offender, they wanted to make an example by having General Loi recalled. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Somali militia fighters attacked the UN headquarters in Mogadishu today, and humanitarian relief programs were reported to be at a virtual standstill. There were no immediate reports of casualties from the attacks, which were aimed at the UN's headquarters and other sites occupied by peacekeepers. Earlier in the day, Somali militants handed out leaflets calling for revenge attacks on American soldiers. Reporters in Mogadishu say the city's been in a state of near anarchy since Monday, when UN forces attacked what they said was a command center used by fighters loyal to Mohamed Farah Aidid. President Clinton told people in Des Moines, Iowa today that federal help is on the way. Iowa's capital city is suffering the worst flooding in its history. From member station WOI, Mark Moran reports.
After promising the Midwest nearly $2.5 billion in flood aid, the president flew over Des Moines and looked at the worst flooding people here have ever seen. During a gathering at a clean water distribution site in Des Moines, Clinton praised Iowans for what he called their heroic efforts.
This is really a triumph of the spirit of the people of this state. I've been very moved by what I have seen, not only from the helicopter, but here in this parking lot today.
While the mood seemed to lighten today, no one here has running water. It could be a week before the 250,000 people that live here have water in their taps, and a month before they can drink it. In a statement that further lightened the mood, city officials said today that the situation is beginning to stabilize. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 27 points to close at 3,542. This is NPR News. The Mexican government said today that it will allow three ships carrying undocumented Chinese immigrants to enter the country, but it will begin sending the immigrants home immediately. More than 600 of the Chinese workers were apparently being smuggled to the United States. The United States had offered to pay to repatriate the Chinese, but a Mexican official said today that Mexico will pay the costs as a humanitarian gesture. Cardiologists at the Johns Hopkins Medical School say an experimental drug appears to dramatically reduce the risk of dying from congestive heart failure, a condition that affects more than 3.5 million people in America. NPR's Brenda Wilson has this report on the New England Journal of Medicine study.
The study to test the drug involved 477 patients who were suffering from chronic congestive heart disease, which causes shortness of breath, fatigue, and an accumulation of body fluids. Half of the patients were given the drug vesnarinone, half received a placebo. Over a six-month period, the risk of death for patients receiving vesnarinone was about half of that of patients on the placebo. 50 on the placebo died during that period, as compared to 26 on vesnarinone. The drug also lowered hospitalization rates and improved the quality of life. The drug's long-term benefits are not known, and doctors still aren't sure how it may enhance survivability. Currently, there is no known cure for congestive heart failure. The handful of drugs used to treat the condition have had no substantial effect in reducing the risk of mortality for a patient, who has a 50% chance of dying in the first year. In Washington, I'm Brenda Wilson.
There was virtually no inflation at the consumer level last month, reducing fears that the country is in for another round of price growth. The Labor Department reported that consumer prices were unchanged in June, the best performance at the consumer level since March of 1991. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hitler never planned to exterminate the Jews. Jews were not gassed in Auschwitz. There was no Holocaust. The Holocaust is a hoax dreamed up by the Jews to get money and sympathy for the State of Israel. Well, those statements are transparently untrue, and yet there's a growing movement of people who believe them and are trying to rewrite history by saying the Holocaust never happened. My guest Deborah Lipstadt says their pseudo-scholarship is a threat not just to Jewish history, but to all who believe in the ultimate power of reason. In her new book, Denying the Holocaust, she examines the workings of the Holocaust denial movement and its assault on truth and memory. Lipstadt is a professor of modern Jewish and Holocaust studies at Emory University. She told me that she started taking the Holocaust deniers seriously when she saw they had made inroads onto college campuses.
They prepared an ad questioning the veracity of the Holocaust, saying that the Holocaust didn't happen, and accusing the political correctness police of preventing students from really learning that the Holocaust didn't happen, claiming that you can question everything on campus, but you can't question the veracity of the Holocaust. They went and then distributed or submitted that ad to a number of universities and university school newspapers, student newspapers, and the student newspapers accepted it and ran it in many cases. And the thing to know is that we're not talking about no place university, or we're talking about major schools and important schools, Michigan, Cornell, Duke, Ohio State, University of Georgia. And these schools, in most cases, accepted the ad and ran the ad. In certain cases, it engendered a tremendous debate on campus as to whether they should or should not. And when I saw the way the students responded, it concerned me deeply.
What, did some people believe the ad?
Well, it wasn't even that they believed it, but one of the responses was, of course, the First Amendment argument, that these people have a First Amendment right to run their ads in the newspaper or even have op-ed pieces in the newspaper. And my argument was that this isn't a First Amendment issue. The First Amendment says that the government can't have any interference in the freedom of anyone you want to put on the air or newspaper wants to put in there on their pages. So for them to claim freedom of press was a sort of murky issue or a questionable issue, on top of which each of these newspapers that ran the ad have pretty strict advertising codes, far stricter than most commercial newspapers. They won't accept X-rated movies. Some don't even accept cigarette ads. So that was one response, and I thought that was a misunderstanding of the Constitution. But what disturbed me far more were two other responses. One response which said, well, yes, we do. When the students on campus, both Jewish and non-Jewish, who protested against the ad, said you wouldn't run an ad that was racist or that was sexist, some of the editors responded, well, this ad is not anti-Semitic. We looked at this ad carefully. The inability to recognize this as anti-Semitism, straight-out anti-Semitism. But most disturbing to me, and I guess this is really when the antennae, you know, my light bulb over my head went off, when the students began to talk about this as an opinion. This is someone's point of view. Northwestern University, they described an unorthodox view of the Holocaust, that these ideas have a right to be heard out there. And I think the Harvard Crimson had it best when they said it's just garbage. And the students couldn't recognize it for the nonsense that it was.
Is there any evidence that the Holocaust denial movement has made any inroads into the mainstream of American thought?
Well, recently there was a Roper poll on this very question, and the Roper organization asked people, is it possible that the Holocaust didn't happen? And 20% of Americans and 22% of high school students said, yes, it was possible. Now, I recognize that if you were to ask Americans, is it possible that John F. Kennedy is alive and well and living in the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia, some would say, yes, it's possible. Or is it possible that Elvis is, you know, living in the Liberty Bell? They might say, yes, it's possible. Americans, you know, there's always going to be a small core that's going to be willing to consider any notion. But even when you factor that out, that response is a response that's disturbing.
Well, as you say in your book, you're studying this to try to understand the fragility of reason and society's susceptibility to far-fetched ideas. So you see this as a case study in our susceptibility to far-fetched ideas.
Absolutely. I did not write this book solely about the attack on the Holocaust or the attack on an aspect of Jewish history, which is, of course, something that concerned me. But I am really concerned if this history is not safe, then no history is safe. If this memory is not safe, no memory is safe. And with the ferment in the world right now, history is up for grabs.
Now, you're often invited onto TV talk shows to debate people from the Holocaust denial movement, and you refuse to debate them. Why?
Categorically, I refuse, and it amazes some people because here I have a new book coming out, and any author wants every bit of PR and any vehicle to promote their book. But I have refused at least four or five national TV shows and numerous local shows and radio shows. I won't debate people who are liars. I will debate someone who wants to argue that, Hitler, the orders came from Hitler, or they came from subordinates up, you know, the idea for the Holocaust came from the bottom, came from the top. I will debate someone who thinks the Holocaust is unique in terms of its barbarity, and someone who doesn't. Lots of things to debate, and lots of differences to discuss here. But I can't debate people who are outright liars, who have no fidelity to the truth, who will just say this didn't happen or this happened or there are no documents, et cetera, et cetera. There's no room for debate there. And I won't give them the credibility of being the other side. See, that's what they want. That's their agenda. That's exactly what they wanted to do on campus. They want to be thought of at this point as the other side of a debate. And that's why they call themselves revisionists. I don't use that term because they're not revising anything. They're denying. But they want to be thought of as simply people exploring the truth. That's how they wrap themselves in this cloak of truth. And the truth is that they're exactly the opposite.
Let's look at the history of the Holocaust denial movement. You trace it to after the war in France, where it really starts seriously. What are the first signs of it after the war in France?
Well, you begin to get a number of Frenchmen who begin to say that the stories are exaggerated, that this can't quite be true, that we don't know if it's precisely as it happened. But in those early years, you're yet to have people saying the gas chambers didn't happen, to say it's an outright hoax, it's an outright fraud. That begins to happen actually in part in France and then picked up very quickly in the United States shortly thereafter. So you've had people trying to deny this from the 1950s, most of them from the extreme, extreme right, political right wing. And they have not only a anti-Semitic, but also a white supremacist agenda.
Well, one of the early people in the United States that said the Holocaust has been exaggerated was George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the head of the American Nazi Party. Now, I guess it was easy for Americans to dismiss him because, I mean, everybody knows that he's an extremist. Everybody knows he's anti-Semitic. Did then people come along who were less easy to dismiss?
That's exactly what's happened today. In fact, it started, I would say, about a decade and a half ago. That up until then, you could write these people off because it was the George Lincoln Rockwells, or it was even the David Dukes, but it was David Duke running around in his sheet and his cone head or whatever the costume is that he wore when he was Ku Klux Klan magician or wizard or whatever the name is. But what the deniers began to do in the late 70s is shed that cloak and don a cloak of pseudo-academic respectability. So they began to publish books. There's one professor of electrical engineering in Northwestern University who published a book denying the Holocaust, The Hoax of the 20th Century, it's called. And it has small margins and lots of footnotes and densely printed, and it looks terribly boring. So people think that, oh, this must be a serious book. And they began to run academic conferences or pseudo-academic conferences to publish a journal that looked like an academic journal, so much so that an undergraduate, an honors student at Yale who was studying history, when he saw the description of the journal, didn't see the journal itself, but saw the description of the journal in a bibliography of journals, sent them a paper he had written in one of his Yale classes because he thought, oh, this sounds like a respectable operation, and much to his mortification discovered that he was published in a denial journal. He was sent $250 by the deniers for the article, and I often say that should, if he had been more experienced, that would have been a clue to him that this wasn't an academic journal because academic journals don't pay and don't publish so quickly. But in any case, that's what they've been doing. They've been cloaking themselves in this aura of respectability, reason, dialogue, and it fools people.
If someone denying the Holocaust starts quoting texts from the movement that sound scholarly and that outsiders don't know is published by the movement, it sounds like, well, you've got evidence, don't you?
Exactly. What they engage in what has been described as a merry-go-round, a cross-fertilization of one quoting the other, quoting the other, quoting the other. Or they'll sponsor a study of gas chambers, which purports to be a serious scientific study, which of course is not. And then they'll quote it as proof, scientific proof that the Holocaust didn't happen. So you get this circular kind of one depending on the other.
There's someone named Austin J. App, who was an English professor at the University of Scranton and at LaSalle College, who in 1973 published a pamphlet called The 6 Million Swindle, Blackmailing the German People for Hard Marks with Fabricated Corpses. And it's this pamphlet, you say, that really outlined the basic principles of what became the Holocaust denial movement. What are some of those principles?
Some of those principles, A, that there was never a program by the Nazis to annihilate the Jews. That the Nazis never planned to, using the lingo of the Nazis, to exterminate the Jews, that the gas chambers were a fraud, that 6 million Jews never died, that many of those Jews are alive and well and living someplace else, and that this is all a Zionist plot. I think that connection to Israel, particularly in App's work, is very, very strong, that this is all a hoax in order for Jews to get a state and to get money.
Who is Austin App, who wrote the pamphlet?
He really was a nobody, you know. He was a professor, with all due respect to the University of Scranton and LaSalle. He was a relatively unknown professor of medieval English. I've met some of his students who found him sort of a stuffy type. But he had this sort of Walter Mitty existence on the side, where he wrote violently anti-Semitic letters to newspapers, to magazines, most of which weren't published, so he eventually published them himself, letters of Austin J. App, in which he accused Jews of trying to destroy Germany, trying to starve Germany out of existence, and being behind the program to completely ruin the rehabilitation of Germany. He was a great Philo-German. He was an anti-Semite as well.
My guest is Deborah Lipstadt. She teaches modern Jewish and Holocaust studies at Emory University. She's the author of the new book, Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Deborah Lipstadt is my guest, author of the new book, Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory. One of the recent points that the Holocaust revision movement is making is the gas chambers couldn't have been used for mass executions. Why are they focusing on that, do you think?
Because I think if they can cast doubt on the gas chambers, they feel they can cast doubt on the rest of it. Because it's the gas chambers that is one aspect of what makes the Holocaust unique. It's this use of modern scientific methods, not guns and not missiles and not scuds, all of which are horrible, but modern science used solely for the purpose of killing people. And if they can pull that out, then they can create doubt in people's minds.
I'm sure you've asked yourself a lot, why is there a group of people who are trying to deny that the Holocaust happened or are trying to downplay what happened during the Holocaust? What conclusions have you come to about that?
Well, I think there are a number of ways of trying to understand these people. Many of them, some of them are kooks and quacks, flat earth theorists, people, you know, one of them wrote a book, Hitler's secret weapon, UFOs, unidentified flying objects, Hitler's secret weapon. They're, you know, so some of them really border on the gray area of rational thinking. Some of them are absolute burning anti-Semites. Some are neo-Nazis and philo-Germans. And some are conspiracy theorists, you know, who see a conspiracy all about. And some are a combination of all the above. Many of them are from the far right wing. Not only, but many are from the far right wing. And many of them have a white supremacist agenda.
You make an interesting point in your book that early on there were a lot of fascists who were in the Holocaust denial movement. And they wanted to disconnect fascism from the Holocaust because the Holocaust just made fascism seem really bad. So to cleanse the idea of fascism, they wanted to downplay or deny the Holocaust.
That's exactly one of the main points I'm trying to make, because while it happened early on, it's happening even more now. If the neo-Nazis and the fascists, or if we call them neo or Nazis and the fascists, but contemporary Nazis and fascists, if they can convince people that the Holocaust didn't happen, then what's so wrong with National Socialism? What's so wrong with Nazism? What's so wrong with fascism? And consequently, Holocaust denial has proven to be very alluring to a lot of extremist nationalists, even intellectuals or academics in the former Eastern Bloc countries, who are very much attracted by a strong-willed right-wing government, such as a National Socialist government, but who are repelled by the Holocaust. So if you can remove the Holocaust, then what's so wrong with National Socialism? After all, they bombed London, we bombed Cologne. They had camps, Buchenwald and Dachau, well, we had camps for the Japanese Americans. There's no comparison between the camps, the Japanese-American camps, which were horrible, but there's no comparing them in their horror to what Buchenwald and Dachau were all about. But they deal in immoral equivalencies. And the only immoral equivalency that they can't find a parallel for is the Holocaust. Let's get rid of that.
There's a an institute that's one of the centers for the Holocaust denial movement called the Institute for Historical Research. You say that they're funded, at least in part, by the Liberty Lobby. What's the Liberty Lobby?
It's the Institute for Historical Review, the IHR, based in California. And the Liberty Lobby is one of the most far-right entities we have in this country. It publishes things like the Liberty Bell and the Spotlight, and a whole nexus, if not directly connected with them, indirectly connected, of far-right kind of publications. The money, they have had the same mailing address as the Institute for Historical Review, the same people right at the helm of one, at the helm of the other. So there's very little question about the connection between the two.
Has there been anyone who's written for one of the publications associated with the Holocaust denial movement who is pretty well known and we'd be surprised to hear that they publish?
Yes, the person who's most surprising is David Irving, who is a very prominent, maybe unknown to Americans, but a very popular historical writer in England, who has written Hitler's Secret War. He just wrote a book about Churchill. He writes books that sell a lot, historical works on World War II. He is a far right, politically connected with the far right, and he has become a denier. He used to be a fellow traveler. He has become a denier.
You've said that some of the people in the Holocaust denial movement are conspiracy theorists. Are there any connections between the Holocaust deniers and the conspiracy theorists who fixate on the Kennedy assassination?
Absolutely. There are quite a few people who are pretty prominent in the JFK conspiracy theory movement who are deniers. or associated with the denial movement. The most prominent of them is Mark Lane, who was one of the earliest to talk about a conspiracy to cover up the killing of JFK, and who was the lawyer for the Institute, has served as the legal representative for the Institute for Historical Review, and is closely connected with them. But there are others as well, whose names wouldn't be known to us, but when you know denial literature, you see them in both places.
You see Holocaust revisionism as just like a case study in how people are trying to rewrite the past with what they're passing off as facts but are just lies. What are some of the other examples of that that you see around now?
Well, I think there's an attempt to play with history of African Americans on both sides. There are those who argue that slavery was not so bad, there are others who argue that Afrocentrists who argue that while Africa hasn't gotten its rightful place, which I think they're right in many educational systems, argue that Africa is the cradle for all, everything that came out that's useful to society has come out of there. I think they're those kinds of revisionist views of history. I think there'll be others that'll come along. We see it in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We see it in lots of places. This attempt to attack history to rewrite history. History is the new battleground.
Why is history the new battleground? I mean, most Americans consider themselves to be totally uninterested in history. The word history is such a turnoff.
Right, people get bored the minute they hear, oh, that's history. In fact, that's the greatest, one of the great put-downs is your history.
Right.
I'm not sure, but I think that we've seen, this attack on history connects with something else, with another intellectual movement, which was very popular the past 10 years, and that's deconstructionism. And I don't mean this to be an attack on deconstructionism, but what deconstructionism argued is that a text has no set meaning. It's the interpretation that the reader brings to the text. And deconstructionism has something to recommend it. It says that voices such as women's voices or people of color voices weren't heard in interpretation of text. But then when people who really didn't understand the movement got a hold of it, and even some who did understand it, and took it to its lowest common denominator, what happened was there's an inability to say, this is nonsense. There's an inability to say, this makes no sense, or this is wrong. It sort of backed into or came in confluence with a moral relativism that has permeated much of American life, starting in academic circles and moving out. It's a fuzzy kind of reasoning, which I find very frightening.
Do you think history has become the new battleground in part because in our search for identity, for roots, for our historical place, our personal historical place in the world, history has become a tool more than it ever has, I think, in American popular culture for giving us a personal identity?
Absolutely. I think people want an anchor. And I think one of the anchors is history. And if the history doesn't exist, I'll make it up. If the history isn't there, I'll adopt it and adapt it to make it my own. And it makes it it's a very fragile instrument. Memory is a very fragile thing. And that's why I think places like the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum are so important, because it's a historical museum that shows the history of National Socialism and the destruction of so many human beings, Jews and non-Jews.
So by manipulating history, you're also manipulating identity.
Absolutely. You're playing with people's identity. And part of, if people don't have an identity and they want to create it, they rewrite history in order to have that identity. But I think the important thing, going back to the actual Holocaust deniers, is that they're also trying to, they have the anti-Semitic agenda, they have the neo-Nazi agenda, and they have an anti-Israel agenda, and they have this sort of conspiracy theory agenda, and they have found that history is the right vehicle to try to advance those agendas.
Deborah Lipstadt is the author of Denying the Holocaust. She's a professor of modern Jewish and Holocaust studies at Emory University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Thank you. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, why the old suburban dream is increasingly out of sync with today's culture. We talk with architect Peter Calthorpe about designing new suburbs, suburbs that are designed for single people and the elderly, as well as nuclear families, suburbs in which you can walk or take public transportation and not be stuck in suburban gridlock. Also, Anne Lamott kept a journal of the first year of her son's life and published it in the book Operating Instructions. We've asked her to keep the stories about her son coming. A new installment coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. An 11th man has been indicted in connection with the plot to blow up several sites in New York City, including UN headquarters. The latest suspect is 42-year-old Ebrahim El-Jabrani, who is already in jail on charges of obstructing justice during the investigation into the bombing of the World Trade Center earlier this year. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
U.S. officials last month arrested eight men and charged them with a scheme to blow up two tunnels, UN headquarters, and a federal building housing the FBI. Two other men were subsequently named in the plot, and today authorities also indicted El-Jabrani. According to the indictment, El-Jabrani and several other suspects discussed bombing different sites in New York City in or around late 1991. This is the first indication by federal authorities that the alleged plot began that early. El-Jabrani's name is already familiar to the public. He was arrested last March after trying to stop FBI agents from searching his Brooklyn apartment during the investigation into the Trade Center bombing. He is to stand trial on that charge on August 2nd. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
President Clinton paid a second visit to flooded areas of the Midwest today and said that he is sending legislation to Congress immediately, calling for at least $2.48 billion in federal aid. After taking a helicopter ride over flooded areas, Mr. Clinton said that he had seen entire towns flooded before, but he had never seen anything on the scale of what he saw today in Iowa. The president praised federal relief efforts now underway, and he called on Congress to move in a speedy manner to approve his aid proposal, adding it was sure to be increased as additional damage estimates come in. U.S. peace negotiator Dennis Ross left the Middle East without achieving a breakthrough on an agreement between Israelis and Palestinians. NPR's Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
Dennis Ross will now have to decide whether to recommend that U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher come to the Middle East in the next few weeks. If Christopher does come, it is a sign that the Clinton administration believes an agreement on a joint declaration of principles is possible. That declaration would lay the groundwork for Palestinian self-rule in the occupied territories. But today, both Israelis and Palestinians seemed pessimistic. Foreign Minister Shimon Peres said no agreement is possible as long as the Palestinians continue to insist that Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem must be part of the autonomy. And Palestinian negotiator Hanan Ashrawi said it may be time to reassess the whole framework of the talks. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 27 points to close at 3,542.55 on volume of more than 285 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. The government of Mexico says it will allow three ships now offshore and carrying more than 600 Chinese boat people to enter the country. Then a government official in Mexico says the Chinese passengers will be sent back home. Officials from the United States and Mexico had been in contact concerning the matter for a week now, and U.S. officials offered to pay the expense of sending the boat people back home to China if Mexico would allow them into the country. In Turkey, the Constitutional Court has banned a pro-Kurdish party from the parliament. The move came at a time of increasing violence in southeastern Turkey, as the Turkish army and a militant Kurdish group are engaged in daily clashes. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Ankara.
Four deputies of the Turkish parliament were dismissed from their jobs today by order of the Constitutional Court. The court also banned the People's Labor Party, a pro-Kurdish political party with 16 members in parliament. In a case brought more than a year ago, the court found that some of the speeches of the party leader, Femi Isiklar, and some actions of the party itself violated the Turkish constitution. Isiklar has become the deputy speaker of the Turkish Assembly. His parliamentary membership has been revoked. The action of the court will likely add to the current tensions in Turkey. The Turkish military chief of staff has threatened drastic action in southeast Turkey to stamp out the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK. The party is outlawed in Turkey. In Ankara, this is Deborah Amos.
According to news reports in Moscow, Russia's central bank has raised its discount rate to 170%. It's the fifth time the rate has gone up in the last 2.5 months. The central bank in Moscow has been raising lending rates in efforts to make borrowing more expensive in Moscow and try to curb rising inflation. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The old suburban dream didn't include traffic gridlock, nor did Americans move to the suburbs in the hopes of breathing polluted air, witnessing the loss of open space, and participating in general environmental degradation. Some of the post-World War II suburbs have become dysfunctional. My guest Peter Calthorpe is designing new alternative communities. Calthorpe is an architect who was named by Newsweek as one of the 25 innovators on the cutting edge. He's the author of the new book, The Next American Metropolis: Ecology, Community, and the American Dream. He says the old suburban dream is out of sync with today's culture. How is it out of sync?
Well, I think in many, many ways, you can look at it from a kind of economist standpoint in which we can no longer afford it. I don't think we can afford it in environmental terms. We can't seem to afford it. Government can't afford to deliver the infrastructure that seems to be necessary to sustain it, the road systems and the water systems, etc. And in a very profound way, the average middle-income household doesn't seem to be able to afford it any longer. We watch people in California and other metropolitan areas sacrificing major portions of their day just to be able to get around in order to be able to still purchase that single-family dwelling. But beyond the cost implications, I think that there's a social dilemma, which is that the demographics of America have changed. You know, we're only about a quarter the nuclear family today. Ozzie and Harriet and two kids really represent one out of four households now.
That's really low.
Yeah. It astounds most people, and yet that's the reality of the situation, 1990 census. So we seem to have an urban pattern built on a post-World War II image, which is the nuclear family in the suburban landscape, which no longer fits who we really are, how diverse we are in terms of age, single people, single parents are on the rise, elderly percentage of our population is on the rise. And when you think about it, a lot of these groups really don't fit the mold when you think about a large home on a large lot in a distant location.
So the houses aren't designed for how we're living today, and the locations aren't right for how we're living today either.
Well, it's almost more than the house. It is more the location or the kind of community is what it really comes down to. You think even of the nuclear family, now there's two workers there. So all of a sudden the kids are coming home alone. They're at the end of a cul-de-sac somewhere. They can't get anywhere by themselves because all roads lead to an arterial, which, of course, is not a place you let a 10-year-old out. And the kids tend to be stranded. Now, a lot of people think that it's good to be there because it's safe, but that doesn't seem to be increasingly the case. There was a very interesting study done of kids, 10-year-old kids in a small Vermont town versus same age group in Orange County suburb. Now, the Orange County suburb is where you go, of course, if you're wealthy and you have you're fulfilling the American dream. But it turns out those kids in the Vermont town had three times the mobility. They could get around on their own. They could experience the world. They could kind of mature in a way with some autonomy. They didn't have to be chauffeured everywhere. But the really startling dimension of that study showed that those kids in Orange County watched four times more television.
One of the models you've come up with as an alternative to the suburb is something you describe as the pedestrian pocket. Would you describe that for us?
Well, it's an old idea, but it's something that is being formulated so it works with our contemporary culture. And it really is the idea of a more integrated, mixed-use neighborhood that's walkable. So that the fundamental principles are that you have diverse housing opportunities. You don't just have the monotony of a series of single-family subdivisions. You try to provide places for a broad spectrum of people. You do it in a framework, a street system that's pleasant to walk along. And the implications are really quite pleasing. It's, and maybe nostalgic, some people call it kitsch. I just think it's kind of fundamental. It leads to things like front porches again, so that when you walk down a street, you see your neighbors. It's safer. It's kind of practical. And lo and behold, it turns out that's kind of what everybody wants anyway. Anyway, that diverse housing gets integrated into communities that have shopping and have recreation and have schools and have jobs, all within a reasonable walking distance. Now, that's not to say that people are going to live and work in the same neighborhood and that we're going to kind of balkanize ourselves down to back to a feudal state. Because the way it really can work is when you link a series of these walkable neighborhoods or pedestrian pockets with transit, it becomes viable for people to use it. And people are going to do whatever's most convenient. And the degree to which the car and its expense and the congestion become less and less convenient is the degree to which they need choices, which unfortunately they don't have.
If you were building a new town from scratch, what kind of public spaces would you want in it?
Well, you have to have a whole range. I mean, first you have to preserve the most sensitive habitat and natural features. You have to let the nature that exists in a region coexist with the human development. And I think that's fundamental, and there's no reason we can't do it. As a matter of fact, the most beautiful places in the world all do that, and that's why people like to be there. So the first type of open space would be natural open space. Then I think you need, jumping all the way down to the neighborhood scale, you need small neighborhood parks that are close enough for kids to walk to again. Because of a false efficiency, we've tended now to build parks larger and larger and more distant, which make them, once again, another auto trip away from home. And also, they become so large that they actually become a little dangerous. So we're for smaller parks, more evenly distributed among the neighborhoods, which can become like a community focus. Another thing that we tend to do in our work is bring back the old village green, which is a tradition in American town planning since we first settled here. Obviously, it's a tradition that goes back to Europe. But a place, an open space at the heart of the community where the housing and the commercial and the civic uses come back together again. And when you do that, all of a sudden you begin to get an identity that's a little stronger than your local shopping center. And it has to do with recombining the commercial world and the civic world. I think when you do that, people begin to get a sense of place again that's been lost in the that landscape of segregated uses that we seem to have evolved to.
Architect Peter Calthorpe is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Peter Calthorpe is my guest. He's an architect based in the San Francisco Bay Area and the author of the new book, The Next American Metropolis, Ecology, Community, and the American Dream. What is the area that you've worked on that you've been most satisfied with so far?
That's a good question. Well, one project, which is we're working on for 1,000 Friends of Oregon, which is an environmental group up in Portland. You know, Portland has been one of the most progressive areas in the country in terms of land planning. Back in the 70s, the state created some legislation that set urban growth boundaries. So Portland's been living within a line so that it doesn't sprawl out too far. And the 1,000 Friends, a very progressive environmental group that actually deals with issues beyond environmentalism, have been a big part of that, and also have tried to be the guardian of those principles. Well, the Department of Transportation in Oregon came along and said, well, the city needs a new beltway, you know, another freeway out at the fringe to handle the next generation's growth in that city. 1,000 Friends looked at that and realized that would cause sprawl well outside of the urban growth boundary. So they asked us to look at and do a feasibility study to show whether or not we could accommodate all the growth within the urban growth boundary and organize it around the new light rail, which they'd already paid for. It was going into that section of the city. Organize that new growth around the transit system so that a new freeway would not be needed. And we were able to show that it was, number one, quite easy to fit the growth within the boundary. Number two, that it could be organized into more walkable and transit-oriented neighborhoods. And number three, if that happened, that people would typically use transit more and use their cars less, and the need for a new freeway would go away. So it was a project at a fairly grand scale, but it sketched out a big future and two self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, if you build the freeway, you will get the sprawl, and therefore you will need the freeway to handle all the cars. If you don't, and you organize the growth around the transit system, then the transit system becomes effective, and you don't need the expense or the environmental degradation of the increased highway system.
What kind of resistance are you usually up against when you're trying to implement one of your ideas?
Lots. I mean, the inertia of the status quo is really quite profound, and people's fear of change, even if it's in a way back to something very familiar, is always present. There is the sense among neighborhood groups now, because development has been so repugnant for so long, that any development is bad, period. And so that, of course, just forces development farther out into the fringes where there aren't neighborhood groups to oppose it. So rather than kind of taking it in and trying to cope with it coherently, as these communities reject it, they actually create more problems. So that's one of the issues, is we call it NIMBYism, not in my backyard. We don't want transit here. We don't want a mix of housing types, because that brings people that are different from us. We don't want, in many cases, they say, we don't even want stores, because in their minds that just means traffic. So there's a lot of that that goes on. Then there's also the development community, which is very slow to take risks, especially in this kind of post-80s, post-SNL crisis world, where they got burned by going too far in the wrong direction. And they're not about to take a risk on anything that's outside of the standard formula. The list goes on, I'm sad to say. You know, there's the traffic engineers who have really been in control of our public environment. You know, it used to be that we had great designers that would think about the quality of public space first. You know, the identity, the character, the grandeur of the parks or the plazas or the monuments or even the simple thing of a beautiful streetscape. And now, largely, I'd say the public domain has been handed over to traffic engineers, whose primary interest is how do you move cars efficiently and quickly. And, you know, anybody can walk out onto any street outside of an old or urban neighborhood and find themselves in an environment that's really designed for the car rather than for people.
Well, here's an important question. Where does the shopping mall fit in your vision?
Well, this is where things get complicated. We have a new order of retail. We don't have mom-and-pop shops anymore, and as much as we kind of would love to fantasize about bringing them back, we can't. I do think it's possible, and this just takes design finesse, and it's part of what is most interesting about this field is trying to find hybrids and trying to create a world that's both convenient to the car and to the pedestrian. But you have to find a hybrid that allows those larger stores to exist, but also find a way to knit them into a neighborhood so they become more than just, a destination along a highway.
Are you able to live in a community now that suits the ideals that you discuss?
You know, I find it interesting that the communities that come closest to the ideals are actually, unfortunately, because there's so few of them now, they're becoming the most expensive places.
Exactly.
They're certainly desirable to live in a neighborhood where you don't have to be on an arterial every time you want to go somewhere. But they tend to be the older, smaller towns, which in the end is where people tend to be gravitating, or the urban centers, the higher quality urban centers.
So do you live in one of those?
Now, I live in Berkeley now, which has a lot of those qualities once again.
Uh-huh.
The mix of housing, mix of, income groups and household types and easy access to lots of different things just down the street.
What do you think
it's really a pattern. This suburban pattern is really only 40 years old. This is what we have to remember. I mean, mankind has thousands and thousands of years of urban history, and only in the last 40 years have we created a physical environment totally dependent on the car.
So it's not too late to try to change it, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm trying to point. Hey, this is a small experiment that needs some serious adjustment.
Peter Calthorpe, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Calthorpe is the author of the new book, The Next American Metropolis. His firm, Calthorpe Associates, is in the San Francisco Bay Area. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton is visiting flood-ravaged Des Moines. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on the flood on All Things Considered?
We're covering the president's visit, of course, Terry, and Robert Siegel, who is in St. Louis, will be doing a piece on the economy of the region between two rivers, which is being very badly affected by this flood. We'll have a piece from Kathy Lohr on the health risks of prolonged flooding, and we will remember the 1927 flood when the Mississippi was out of its banks and covering hundreds of thousands of square miles. Anne Garrels is in Macedonia. She will report on the porous state of the border with Serbia. Much of what is keeping Serbia going is flowing in from Macedonia.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A couple of months ago, we interviewed writer Anne Lamott about her new book, Operating Instructions. It's a journal of the first year of her son Sam's life. Anne's raising Sam on her own with the help of friends and family. We wanted to hear more about her experiences as a single mother. So from time to time, she'll report on life at the Lamotts.
My young son Sam makes me walk more slowly because he's seriously mesmerized so often. He gapes awestruck at trees, bees, soda cans, deer or the dust bunnies under our bed, and I tag along gaping at him because he sees and says and does the oddest things. It's actually very much like getting to live with an extraterrestrial. He used to remind me most of E.T. I remember being at the kitchen table one morning reading the paper when he came in. He was a little groggy and still in his jammies, and he went to play with the pots and pans. After a while, he walked past, behind me, and said, "Bye-bye." And I said, without looking up, "Bye-bye, darling." And he said, "Bye-bye" again, and I said, "Bye-bye, Sam," and then finally did look up. He was waddling along exactly like E.T., and rather grimly dragging a wearing blender by the cord, like it was a pull toy, like a little dachshund on a string or something. I got up and followed him. He dragged it to his room, and I thought, does he have ice cream and milk in there? Is he going to make me and the kitty a milkshake? But I think it was some sort of guy thing, like he was just taking it back to his cave. Later he went through a stage where he was more like Mork, with PMS. One morning, for example, he climbed into bed with me around 6:30 or so. He wanted a bottle of apple juice as usual, which I was trying to wean him of because it cut his appetite for breakfast. The temptation was to give him the bottle so that we could both sleep for another hour, but I decided not to, so I got us out of bed. He was very depressed and on the verge of tears, wanting his bottle. I can certainly relate to that. And he kept pulling me to the refrigerator and wrapping my fingers around the handle. Finally, I sat him down and explained that we really need to wake up and not drink a bunch of juice, but instead to sit down together and eat a nice, healthy breakfast. And at that point, he began to weep. "Oh, honey, what's the matter?" I said. And he said tremulously, "I don't want breakfast." And I said, "What do you want?" And he said tearfully, "I want dinner." So I made him SpaghettiOs, and he wolfed them down. These days, Sam reminds me more and more of Saint-Exupéry's space traveler, the Little Prince, and so reminds me more and more of the rest of us, too. He's very earnest in wanting to make some sense of this strange place where he has landed, and some of his actions have a delicate, haiku-like beauty. For a long time now, his favorite prop has been the little spritzer bottle that I use when I iron something, which is, just so you don't get the wrong idea, about twice a year. When I handed it to him one morning, though, it was less than 3 seconds before he spritzed me right in the eyes. Then, before I could get it away from him, he'd spritz the kitty in the eyes, too. He was stalking the dog when I finally nabbed him. I explained that he could not spray anybody in the house, that otherwise I would take it away. So he toddled off, and I couldn't find him for a few minutes, until I finally opened the front door and found him standing there on the doormat, spritzing the rain.
Anne Lamott is the author of Operating Instructions, a journal of my son's first year. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Chris Fraley, Ron Barron, and Bob Balls. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Devin Reif. Our program is directed this week by Naomi Person. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Designing Cyberspace. A new digital information highway is in the formative stages that will carry voice, data, and video services. We'll talk with Mitch Kapor, co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which wants to make sure everyone has access to the highway. Kapor also founded the Lotus Software Company. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.